Brexit is all about geography. It's all about borders. It's all about issues of identity, and a lot of it's about history. If you're trying to work out what's strange about Britain, because there has to be something odd to be the first country to try to leave, particularly a large country, you kind of expect a little small country to go first. We're one of the five large countries, Spain, Italy, France, Germany, and us. One thing that's odd about us is that we're the economically most unequal country. The gap between rich and poor in the UK is bigger than the gap, apart from a couple of Baltic states occasionally. No other European country has the kind of inequalities we have. And then there's a question, well, could that be part of the reason? But then you have to ask the question behind the question, why do we end up with being the country with the biggest inequalities? I'm not going to give you the answer. I don't know the answer as to why we did Brexit. I'm just going to show you things that I think are interesting and concentrate on a few of things. The only thing I definitely know is that the press are reporting the geography of the Brexit vote wrong. And that is because the one thing we know about people who voted is we know where they lived. We know how many people in Oxford voted to leave, how many voted to remain, and how many didn't vote. We know that for the whole country. The majority of people who voted to leave lived in the south of England. And I'll go on about this a bit later. The prevailing story you hear is that Brexit was something that people in the north wanted, despite the fact that most people who voted to leave lived in the south. The population of the north is smaller, but more importantly, a much higher proportion of people in the north didn't vote at all. And that's forgotten. One of the interesting questions is, why is the geography of the vote being misrepresented? It's partly because not many journalists did geography at school, but I think it's also to do with the instant reaction to what happened. These are the kind of things I'm going to talk to you about very quickly. Fear of immigration, which is geographical. Immigration is all about moving across borders. Hostility to EU, the geography of the Brexit voters, the effects of inequality, empire, British Empire. This country was the heart of the largest empire the world has ever known just 100 years ago. We don't tend to teach much about it. We don't teach much about it in schools, we don't teach much about it in universities. And lastly, my conclusion in hindsight, I was a Remainer, that's very predictable. However, in hindsight, I think 52-48 for Leave is absolutely perfect. Because, well, you couldn't have known it at the time, if it had gone the other way, if Remain had got 52 or 54 or even perhaps 60%, this would have carried on. The people who wanted to leave were fairly determined. They would have secured a second referendum, maybe a third referendum. Everything would be being blamed on immigrants. And I think it wouldn't have stopped. Whereas this means that we've now got to work out what we're going to do. That's just my view. I'm going to make sure I stop in 35 minutes so there's enough time for you to ask questions before I annoy you too much with my views. And I've got too many graphs, so I'm going to ignore that one and just go straight to that one. That's a graph over time of the number of people living in the country who are born in another country, going from 1841 all the way to 2011. At every census since 1841, we've asked people, where were you born? Originally, Ireland was the largest country for people coming to what is now the UK. Ireland was part of the UK back then. And that had a lot to do with empire. I think Ireland is the only place in the world which has a smaller population now than it did in 1830-1840 due to a devastating famine that we in England decided not to help out with very much. You see some movement in 1901. I think I'm going to show you a poster later. Part of that was migration from Eastern Europe. There was people fleeing pogroms and being burnt, and Jewish immigration, which was attacked at the time as, this is terrible, how can you let these people from Eastern Europe in? Then we get a bit of a lull in the 1920s and 30s, and then another rise in the 40s, 50s and 60s. We went out to the Caribbean. Enoch Powell actually went out as health secretary to beg people to come and work in the health service. We didn't have enough people to do the work, so we went to Aston. And then when people arrived in the 1950s and 1960s, we said how terrible it was they were arriving. In this city, the biggest employer for most people was the car factory. The car factory had a, what's called a colour bar until the, it might be 1956, but that's just my memory. If you were a black man, you were not allowed to work on the line in the car factory. We forget all these things. And then you see we're at about 3 or 4 million people in the country, but it sort of zooms up to 8 or 9 million, and the latest rise is people from the European mainland, and that's that little triangle there. So that's the kind of, it's all terrible, too many people arriving, too many coming in kind of rhetoric. You can look at this another way. Exactly the same data. I've just put the people born in the UK in as well, the people not born in Britain. And you can see it doesn't look quite as dramatic. But you might still think, well, that's a lot of people. How many of you were born in Oxford? Got your hands up higher? How many were not born in Oxford? Welcome, immigrants. Okay. You're always quite high. I always ask this question in Oxford. And normally, in public meetings, it's a very large, vast majority were born outside of Oxford and Oxfordshire. Because this is a city of migrants. You're younger, so you're still nearer to where you were born. But most of you, because you're in the sixth form, you're doing A-levels, you're going to move further when you're 18, and you move again when you're 21. You may leave the country and be an immigrant elsewhere. People move about. Let's forget that and look at that. This is the European map from 2014 of the rates of immigration in each part of Europe. And what you're looking at is a cartogram. It's a population cartogram. If you like, what we've done with the whole of Europe is what you've just done in the lecture theatre. We've moved everybody about, so you've got an even population density. The population density here is about one person every half a metre. It's a bit crowded on this row, because you're being southern, you could be brave and sat there at the front. But similar population density. Here, this is the UK, that's Ireland. This is Dublin, that's Belfast, this is London, Oxford's kind of here. This is France, that's Paris, Spain, that's Madrid, that's Barcelona. This is Switzerland, this is Greece, which is largely Athens. So you have to, how many of you have seen a cartogram before? A few of you? Right, eventually we're going to take over and we're going to have normal maps in human geography. The advantage of the cartogram is it stops you looking at areas where nobody lives. So the amount of dark blue on this map is actually proportional to the number of people living in areas of very high immigration. Dark blue are places where more than a fifth of the population were born in another country. So most people in Europe don't live in a dark blue area. Most people in Europe live in a yellow area, where less than 5% of people are born abroad. That's the normal situation for a normal European person. There aren't many people around you who weren't born in the country you were born in. And the interesting thing is that if you look at most of Britain, you'll see it's yellow. And to find an area of yellow as big as that, you have to go over to Eastern Europe or Turkey. So the experience of most people in Britain is they live somewhere where almost everybody else around them was born in Britain, often very locally. We're not a country where people are surrounded by immigrants. People don't know that because they get newspapers that tell them that they're surrounded by immigrants. So you actually have to look at the data and see, but most people aren't. If you live in London, particularly central west London, then there are lots and lots of people who are born in another country. And if you live in Ireland, there are lots of people born in another country. Normally, that other country in Ireland, if you live in the north, it's people who are born in the Republic. If you live in the Republic, it's people who are born in the north. Because in Ireland, since the Good Friday Agreement, where you're born doesn't matter. You can easily live one side or the other. You have complete rights. Nobody's going to tamper with that at all, because there is no border in Ireland. Because we have an agreement to say there was no border in Ireland. So Ireland has a high number of people born in another country because there is no border in Ireland. Our politicians haven't yet learned that there is no border in Ireland. They're going through an educational process at the moment, learning that there is no border in Ireland. So you get an idea of the pattern. And if you know about the Brexit vote, and I'll show you a map of the vote in a minute, the areas that voted majority remain were Northern Ireland, with lots of immigrants, London, with lots of immigrants, Scotland, not that many, but for different reasons they did. And it's the areas where there were fewer immigrants that were most likely to vote Leave. And when you ask people why they voted Leave, often immigration was the same thing. Elsewhere in Europe, the area with the highest immigrants is Switzerland. Partly the shape of the country, it's kind of long and thin, it's got mountains in the middle, it's very near to other countries. Then Paris has quite a few. Successful cities tend to have immigrants, but the really big area is here, which is the Costa del Sol in Spain. And the biggest group of immigrants there are English. We don't call them immigrants, we call them expats. And currently, as of the 29th of March, they're going to lose their right to healthcare in Spain. They tend to be elderly. So you're going to meet them, because if they fall sick after 29th of March, they've got to come back to Britain to get treated. And they don't need a home. And they don't work, because they're pensioners. So it's going to be really interesting, but some of you can help look after them, because we're all going to be in it together. And at the same time, we're going to make things really uncomfortable for 3 million young, fit, highly educated people who are here from the mainland, who come and do all the dirty, dangerous jobs, and they're going to go back. But that's okay, because you can do what they do. So we're all going to be absolutely fine. Don't worry. I'll skip through that. This is the Leave and Remain vote over time. It kind of went up and down, up and down, up and down. David Cameron called the referendum at the point he thought he could win it. And he was wrong. And I'm going to skip that as well. It's about, if anybody wants to ask about voting, we can come back to that. But I draw too many graphs. Here's the map. This is the map of which areas will majority leave, which are blue, majority remain are yellow. And this one shows you how leave and remain they were. So the centre of London, with the most immigrants, people most strongly wanted to remain. The immigrants didn't get a vote. To get a vote, you had to be born basically in Britain. So it wasn't the immigrants voting to remain, it was the British friends and neighbours of the immigrants who voted to remain. Here we are in Oxford. This is a little capital of Remain, about 75% Remain. There's Cambridge. So you see it's all a bit posh. It's the posh areas that were really Remain. It's Bristol, Cardiff. The Welsh-speaking parts of Wales were Remain, Manchester was Remain, Liverpool was Remain, Scotland was very heavily Remain. But that's got more to do with Scottish people disliking London and bureaucrats, rather than English people disliking Brussels. And Ireland, although it's majority Remain in yellow, is quite split. And that's largely over sectarian Catholic Protestant ground still. The map is fascinating because it doesn't look like any other map of the human geography of Britain. Most human geography maps look very similar to each other. They tend to reflect poverty. So the map of life expectancy looks like the map of GCSE results, looks like the map of house prices. They're similar. This is different. So part of being a geographer trying to understand it is you immediately see we've got a problem because we've got something we haven't seen before. And the question is, why are they voting Remain down here on the Isle of Wight? Why are they voting, Leave? Why are they voting Leave in Birmingham? Why are they solidly voting Leave, actually in outer London suburbs?
Just click forward.
Each one of these little bricks is a parliamentary constituency. And what we've done is we've divided them up into the ones which were least deprived, the poshest areas, right down to the 10th of parliamentary constituencies that are the most deprived. Now, in the poshest areas, Remain does very well. The best off people in Britain really benefit from being part of the European Union. If you go skiing twice a year in winter, you really don't want to have to get a visa when you fly off to the Alps. If you've got a nanny from Finland, you want your nanny to be able to come in. You can kind of see why the best off areas voted Remain so much. But if you forget about them for a second and look at the 90% rest of Britain, the places that were most solidly leave, this is the red areas, all these constituencies weren't just leave, it was leave by a large margin, 3% or more, are decile 4, 5 and 6. So it's middling. Not the poorest third, they're slightly less likely to be leavers, although it's still majority leaving, the more remainers. It's the middle England leave vote. And you know, if you're going to remember anything from this, the fascinating thing about the Brexit vote was it's people in average houses in average areas in the south of England who were middle class, they probably owned their house, the house could be worth 300,000, 250,000. The majority of them voted Conservative, those were the Leavers. 70% of Labour voters voted to Remain. This is a Conservative Southern England thing. It is not about people in Stoke-on-Trent or Middlesbrough or Sunderland. What happened on the night? How many of you watched the result? Because you were pretty young. Did you stay up to watch it? A few of you. Okay. The first result on elections and referendums always comes from Sunderland. Sunderland prides itself on having runners, which are young people running with buckets to get the vote in as fast as possible. And on the night, it was assumed that Britain was going to vote Remain. The first result comes in from Sunderland, and it's a shock, because Sunderland votes by quite a large margin to leave. And the camera zoomed in on the woman with blonde hair who had two male friends who had were going bald. And that became the image of leave. And that second that happened. And then the story carried on about it's people in the north who left. Skip through that. If you take Essex, Essex is a large county. More people voted leave in Essex than in, I won't read them out because there's too many, but in all these areas of the North and Wales put together, Essex provided more leave voters. All these areas have a bigger electorate than Essex, but Essex provided more leave voters. Kent, more people voted leave in Kent than all these places put together that are typified as being Northern Leave areas. I think the most convincing is Hampshire. More people in Hampshire, so some of you are from Hampshire, Winchester, some of you Winchester people? Yeah, you'll Leave Central, which nobody's told you, you'll Leave Central. More people voted Leave in Hampshire than the combined population of Bolsover up in North Doncaster near to Bolsover, Hull, Chesterfield, Salford, Stoke-on-Trent, where the Prime Minister went for the last few days to do a speech, they always get to Stoke, and they're talking about Brexit, and Sunderland. Nobody ever says Hampshire's where we did it, but more people voted leave in Hampshire. These areas had more voters. Fewer people voted leave. I'll stop it. You see, you get slightly obsessed with a really simple thing to be misunderstood about a vote. But if you're wondering, why is this thing tearing the Conservative Party apart? Well, the areas that were most strongly leave in the country were their areas. Almost all the constituencies of Hampshire vote for Conservative MPs. So the Conservative Party is partly preoccupied with Europe and leaving because a significant number of people who vote for them are preoccupied with that. Inequality. People say they've had enough. Getting a vote, the first vote in your life that might actually matter. Because although you're all going to get to vote in a general election, unless you're given a marginal constituency, your vote ain't going to make much difference, given we won the first past the post. The referendum, for many people, was the first time in England you'd ever been given a vote where your vote actually mattered. And the choice was, keep things as they are, or change. And one interesting question is, why do so many people want to change? Now, part of it is anti-immigration, bit of racism, stoked up by tabloid newspapers, and so on. Part of it is that things really have got worse for most people. This graph at the top is about inequality in Britain. And it's how much income the best off 10% take. So I'm solidly in the best off 10%. I don't have to worry about money. I know that if they stop my pay, me and my family are okay for about 3 months, maybe 4 months. I've got a credit card that will get me out of the country. I don't know if I could get another job, but I'm okay. I'm in the 10%. I don't worry about the bills. One reason I don't worry about the bills is that I'm part of a group who take 40% of all income every year, leaving the rest of the population with 60%. And that's really unequal. You know, I'm taking four times more than the average person in my group. When I was your age, we were down there taking about 27%. It may not seem much of a difference, but it's about an entire National Health Service and a half difference in terms of how much more I get. I'm paid twice as much than my father was paid. My father was a doctor in this city, pretty well paid. So I'm paid twice as much in real terms than him. I'm happy to tell you about it because I don't feel that guilty because I live in a house which is three times smaller than the house I grew up in. Because inequality rising means that bankers from London now can live in the kind of houses I grew up in. So nobody kind of feels guilty about where they are because there's a group above you who are richer and richer and richer. If you compare internationally, this is the OECD League Table of Inequality. I'm not showing you 30 countries down here, which are all the countries of Europe, Japan and so on. I'm just showing you the worst cases. And the most unequal OECD countries in the world are Mexico, Chile, Turkey, which has a particular leader at the moment who's a despot, United States, which has a leader who's a despot, the Baltic States, Russia, which has a leader who's a despot, United Kingdom, who's got a leader who's a geographer, and she's not as bad as those ones. Israel, we're slightly more unequal than Israel. Israel is a divided country. That's Israel including the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. So we're odd, I'm just trying to get you, we're odd, you're living in an odd country in an odd time. To you it appears to be very normal because you don't know another country. But it's very different, from the country I grew up in. Oxford in the late 60s and 70s was the most equal it had ever been. And what that meant is that people didn't worry about what school they went to so much. You had similar holidays to each other. Hardly anybody went skiing, but you went camping. Better off people had a car, people who weren't better off had a bike, because it wasn't that different. And then the gaps got wider and wider and wider. And inequality has various effects. And it's very hard to prove this, but it's interesting just to look at it. This is just one. These are the rich countries of the world. This is a measure of how unequal they are. This is the United States, this is the UK. Here's the Netherlands, Japan, Finland. Finland's one of the most equal. And this is how well people do at maths in an international maths test. At age 24, and this is key. At age 16 or 17, your age, or 18, how many are 18? 18 year olds? 17? 16? Too shy to put your hand up? Okay. If we did your maths test now, you'd do okay. Particularly you lot, because you've got your ace. Are you numbers? Are you nines and eights and sevens? Okay. Anyway, you've got those. You just had to go through the horror of maths GCSE. You've learned how to do it. If we were to give you a maths test at age 24, and the rest of the population, you'd on average be down here, and this lot are still good at maths. Now, it's not that this lot are particularly geeky. It's probably that they're growing up in less competitive countries. And in less competitive countries, it is possible in schools to teach maths in a way in which you might actually enjoy maths, and in which you don't memorise the triangle rule to get your 6 points of question right in your GCSE to make sure you get an A or an A star. You actually learn maths, and there's a difference. It's worse in America, but there are all kinds of things that inequality affects. It affects our education. So we tend to think if we get very high exam results, then we're well educated. We tend to ignore the international comparisons over what we can do. But what happens if exam results matter more and more and more is you have to teach people how to get high exam results. And that's never the same as actually teaching them about geography or about maths. It's about how you write the answer that will get the top grade. Or, in an average school, it's how do you get the most children you can from what used to be called a D to a C, or a 5 or a 6. Or for a school that's higher up in the rankings, it's how do we get these stellar GCSEs so when you apply to the stellar university you look really, really good. It has an effect. The British Empire, and I've got 10 minutes left or less. That's a map of the countries that were in the British Empire at one point or another. It's sized by the current population, just to point out how big India was and how important India is. Because on a normal map of the world, you don't realise that the most important part of the British Empire was India, Pakistan, Bangladesh were the later parts that split off. It was huge. The dates when the countries joined are there. As far as I'm aware, nowhere apart from New Zealand was the joining that voluntary. You didn't really give people a choice. New Zealand, it wasn't that voluntary, but at least had a treaty. And the dates of the country leaving the empire also there. And in most cases, that really wasn't, said, oh, time for us to go. They kicked us out, one way or another. Which is partly why we don't teach about the empire. If you were all in China, and you've been taught in the Chinese education system, you'd know about the Opium Wars. You'd know that because China didn't want to buy anything from us, we packed opium into ships, opium grown in India, which we made the Indians grow it because it's our colony, packed it into ships, took gunboats over, and forced them to buy our opium and destroy China. They're still a bit annoyed about it. They're all taught about that. We don't teach about that. We don't teach that much that we took people from one continent and enslaved them, took them to another, and made them pick cotton, and took the cotton back to another, and then made it into garments in Manchester, and destroyed the textile industry in the whole of the subcontinent, so they bought our goods. If you go to New Zealand and go to a supermarket, you'll see above the aisles the word Manchester. And the word Manchester in New Zealand means linen. Because we were the centre of the world. We like to think of this as a great civilization thing, we built railways, whatever, but we didn't give people much choice about it. Here's the last colony going. This is Hong Kong in 1997. That's the current Chancellor of the University of Oxford, Chris Patten, wiping a tear from his daughter's eye. So before you were born, but the story was she was crying because it was so sad that the last colony was going. She was about your age. She was crying because she was going out with a bloke called Alex, who was really good at surfing, which she's written about this later. But we told ourselves a kind of story which is different to the reality of things. Just to the side of there in the picture in the book, there's a young Prince Charles, and he looks really, really nervous because he didn't know what to do when a young lady cries. Let's click through that, ignore that. This is about how big our trade is with India. Essentially, India doesn't buy anything from us, apart from a few weapons. And I'm going to click through this. I could talk about the people involved. Boris, Dominic Cummings, but I won't because I'm droning on too long. Lots of really interesting things happened in the last 2 years. which will matter for a very long time. You're going to hear the word Brexit to the point you die, I'm afraid. It's going to be the defining thing at the start of your life. When my mother was 14, she was taken to a meeting in Leeds Town Hall to hear a discussion about a thing called the Suez Crisis, 1956. And she can still remember this. The Suez Crisis was when we invaded Egypt because of the French, and the Americans told us not to, and then we kind of went back a bit embarrassed, and it was very embarrassing. And it led to political turmoil and uproar, and the Prime Minister went. But then it led to the 1960s, which were fun, and things got better. So my best guess about what's going to happen is we're going to get another 1960s in about 4 years from now. I'm optimistic. Feelings. Age was really important. The older people were, the more likely they were to vote leave. Younger people, less likely. This is a BBC survey, a enormous survey, done in England, asking people last year, how proud or embarrassed are you to identify yourself as English? And the interesting thing is the sort of change over time. Most people are still proud to identify themselves as English, but the older they are, the more likely they are. And you see that little rise of embarrassment, particularly amongst the young. Patterns, we're always looking for patterns and trying to guess from the patterns what they might be telling us. This graph really matters now, and I'm getting towards the end. This graph was produced by Standard & Poor, which is a financial firm, about 2 or 3 weeks before the vote in 2016. And it's Standard & Poor's estimates of which countries other than the UK will be most financially affected by Brexit. And they produced the graph to their investors because people needed to know, you know, this is going to have an effect. If I've got money to invest, do I invest it in Germany, or do I put it in Ireland, or what do I do with it? And it's really fascinating because the most affected country, they said before the vote, would be Ireland, other than us. So they knew that it would really matter to Ireland, because some goods are transported across the border, some goods made in the Republic of Ireland, go on a ship from Dublin, the ship is landed on one side of Britain, it goes across Britain, goes on another ship to the mainland. If it becomes harder to transport goods from Dublin to Amsterdam, it affects Ireland. Ireland was the most affected, then Malta. Malta is a former colony, little warm island, strong connections to Britain still. Then Luxembourg, which is a tiny country that has financial connections to us, I'll say essentially involving tax avoidance, but bankers would say something else. Anyway, Luxembourg has to worry, not much, but a bit. Then Cyprus, which is another former colony with links to Britain. Then Switzerland, which isn't in the EU. And then Belgium, which is pretty small. Now what really matters about that, these countries, is they're tiny. So we've been doing these negotiations with the EU27, and the only places that stand to lose out much from Brexit are the tiny ones that don't really matter and get much of a voice. The effects on Germany, France, Italy and Spain, fairly minimal. The Germans will find somebody else to buy their cars. They have a factory in Oxford, which is run by 1,200 robots. Each robot is designed to fit in the back of a lorry, so you can ship the entire factory in a week to the Austrian-Czech border. The factory is going to close on the 29th of March, that's already agreed, and they don't know whether it'll open again until 2 or 3 weeks later. The Mini is 1% of our entire industrial exports from Britain. They produce a Mini every 1 minute, 3 seconds, so I don't know, a Mini goes for 30,000, 35, somebody should tell me. But basically every minute we produce a Mini car. And it makes a lot of money for the country. But to make a Mini, you need to have engine parts that come over the channel, and you can't make a Mini without being able to move things around. There are 6 robotic lines in the county car plant. You can go visit, it's £12, it's worth seeing. And there's 1 manual line, largely manned by Eastern European labour. Uses a Mini every minute, Mini making about £25,000, £30,000 money. My university, we produce a postgraduate student every hour at roughly the same cost. So we at Oxford University would have to become 60 times more efficient to replace the actual earning power of the Cowley Park plant. Just give you an idea of, you know, the idea of me becoming 60 times more productive. You know, can't do it. You could charge postgraduate students a lot more than £25,000 or £30,000 to do a master's degree, but they wouldn't come. So it's really interesting, and it's the next few weeks, and we don't know what's going to happen. It's large. I'm going to skip past these. What could happen? Three things now. We've kind of narrowed it down to three. One thing is that we could still revoke Article 50, or delay. Theresa May can do that on her own. She doesn't need permission from anybody else, doesn't need to ask the Cabinet, doesn't have to go into Parliament. She writes the letter and puts it in a postbox to Brussels, and if it gets too late, she can send an email about 10 o'clock on the 29th of March, and she can cancel it, as if it never happened. Only her, only the Prime Minister. Been tested in the courts in Europe, she has the power to revoke Article 50 at any time. She doesn't want to, or she says she doesn't want to, but she does, and that's a possibility. She could revoke it and say it's a delay, because of course we could always have another referendum. But that's one possibility. And the way that would happen is the level of fear would rise. There's a hospital in Birmingham this morning that said that in the event of a hard Brexit, it would cancel all routine operations. You've heard lots of things, but the fear will increase over the next few weeks, and some of it will get more serious. And it's that kind of circumstance in which it is possible she could revoke Article 50. In her 558-page document, there were only 115 words about the entire finance industry of Britain in the negotiated agreement. It's very hard for British banks to carry on working as they do without passports. And there's very little time left for them to get passports to be allowed to operate in the rest of Europe. So that's the first possibility, revoke or delay. But the easy way to delay is revoking. The hard way to delay is you have to ask all 27 leaders have to agree to a delay. If one of them hangs out, you can't have a delay. The second possibility is that some agreement is actually reached over this big document that has been agreed in Brussels. So she's heading off now to ask if a few things can be altered. They're saying absolutely no way can they be altered. She's going to come back. Maybe the MPs will go for it, maybe not. It's worth watching. It may be very boring to you, but later on as you get older, people will ask about, you know, were you there when that happened? And you will say, yes, I watched it. And you one day can be a really old, boring person who talks about the fact you were there and sort of thing. That might happen. And the third option is hard Brexit on the 29th of March. That's entirely possible. Hard Brexit on the 29th of March means that nothing is agreed, which means that a lot of people suddenly find themselves inside this country but without the kind of rights they had the day before to use a health service. Potentially the right for their children to go to school, those kind of things. And a lot of people will leave when they manage to get a place on the planes or whatever. They might leave before if it looks like a hard Brexit is likely. Quite a lot have already left. We've had a drop of 100,000 already of people who haven't come or left. Lots of people won't come. I won't go through any more about the hard Brexit. It's not necessarily great. Kind of thing you predict if it looks like we're getting towards a hard Brexit. People start buying lots of toilet bowls because those with memories remember what happens. The items you really need is a toilet bowl, food, that kind of thing. Don't panic. Don't panic. We're very, very well behaved. We tend to queue. Let's go through that. Why is all this going on and it's all kind of so quiet? And this is something I think to be hopeful about. These are figures from an international survey about how much people protest. Almost half of all adults in France have been on a protest. Right, that's what the French do. Spain, Italy, Denmark, over a third. Germans, about a third of Germans, 30% of people protest. We are the outlier of the whole of Europe. Only one in six adults in Britain has ever been on a march or something else to complain about things. We're really odd. And that might have something to do with our history. We kind of put up, shut up, stiff up a lip, and so on. So, and that could be advantageous, because in the event of a hard exit, what we really want is for people not to panic, and to queue orderly, not to rush into the supermarket to buy the toilet rolls, but when somebody tells them to wait at the entrance door, or even only two toilet rolls each, behave. It's a really interesting natural experiment to see if we get to that point. We don't know what's going to happen. It is serious, so I'm not kind of watering it down for you too much. I don't think we're going to get to that. I would be amazed if we got to that. Majority of MPs don't want that. And it would be like the Suez crisis, but worse and more embarrassing, but much, much, much better than something like a war. So the kind of good news about Brexit is it's not like a war. And the interesting thing about Brexit is it's very traumatic. It tells you something about our generation who are older than you, the inability of older people to get on with each other and work out what they're going to do. And the last time that happened, which was the Second World War or the Suez Crisis, younger people decided to vote, decided to take control, decided to do things differently, took over government, voted in different political parties and changed the system. And this is partly why I think we'll get the 1960s again. So I think the young generation are going to be really, really annoyed that something happened that had nothing to do with them because they weren't even allowed to vote for it. I'll stop there. Please think of a question or ask the person on the telephone if they've got a question for me. thank you for your attention. We've got about 10 minutes. Anything? Go on.
I've got a question. Yeah. Is it all protest cancelling? Has anybody got an estimate on how much money it's cost us in terms of politicians' time, preparations, planning, document writing, all of that kind of stuff?
There's official counts of the money, which the government say they put this so much aside and so on. But the huge one is house prices. Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, says a hard Brexit equals a 30% drop in house prices. A relatively long road in Chelsea is worth £2 billion. So a 30% drop on just that road. So the 66% of the wealth of Britain more is held in form of housing. If the house prices plummet, it's absolutely enormous. But forget all the direct costs completely. And you know, housing is massively overvalued in this country. You know, the houses in Oxford cost far too much. But you want them to come down gradually. Yeah. You don't want them to all come down in one month to German levels. There's a question at the back.
Do you think 16-year-olds should have been able to vote in the referendum?
Yes.
Do you think that should have been referendum?
My personal view is yes. They did get to vote in Scotland. We send 16-year-olds into the army. You can get married, I think, still at 16. It just seems to be to be ridiculous. Given that, you know, either you take away all those things and say you really are children, or if you're saying essentially you are quasi-adults, that's sex. You know, if you like people to do other things at 16, ideally you don't let them vote. It does, I think, a little bit insulting. So that would be my preference. And also it helps massively get people into the habit of voting. Voting amongst young people fell dramatically after 1991. Because in 1991, before we had a thing called the poll tax, but if you didn't register to vote, you didn't vote, nobody knew you were there, you didn't pay the poll tax. And since then, 1992 election onwards, we've had really low turnout. Until the election last year. And once you vote once in an election, you tend to vote again and again. So I would get you voting at 16 or 17 when you're at home with your parents, and maybe it is doing it. Go on.
What did you vote for?
I voted for Remain. I voted for Remain, predictably, but 98% of Oxford academics probably voted for Remain. And this is part of the issue, because the elites, the posh army, the elites, the BBC, the churches, TUC, the CPI, the Trade Union Congress, they were all for the man. So the entire establishment was for one thing. So it was a pretty insulting vote to give people, because you're basically saying, we're going to give you a choice, but we're all telling you to vote one way. And it, you know, part of it's quite funny that the population took all this advice and went, no, we don't believe you, we're voting out.
Do you think there's a chance that Brexit could trigger a collapse in the EU?
I think the opposite. I think a chance of collapse was much higher before it. When Greece was being really nasty to, so Germany was being really nasty to Greece, and Hungary was talking about leaving. What Brexit has done, and it's done an incredible service to the EU, it's shown EU, the 27 countries, you can't leave. Even if you've only got one tiny land border with Ireland, the effects of trying to leave after 40 years of integration are so terrible that you just don't think of doing it. Greece has a land border with Bulgaria now. So my prediction is that Brexit actually means the EU27 will be much more solid. And the other thing, one of the slides I didn't show you, we send more members of the European Parliament who are to the right of Conservatives, that is mainstream European People's Party Conservatives. We send more, the majority of our MEPs are far right, as far as Europe's concerned, than any other European country. So when people talk about the rise of the far right in Europe, it's us. And as of the 29th of March, our MEPs are no longer there, so the Parliament doesn't have this big far-right bloc in it. You there?
To what extent do you think came down this corrupted
the 2016
vote?
What's that matter? A little bit. They like people to think a lot, because the people who run Facebook and these companies would love you to think they can have a big effect, because then you pay them if you've got money to market stuff. But remember, the main block of voting out were old. How many of your grandparents were on Facebook? Can you hand up? How many grandparents? Few? Okay, look. The majority of your grandparents would have voted leave. A lot of people. Like, Cambridge Analytica gets them because they're not on Facebook. Yeah?
Do you think there should be a second referendum?
Personally, no. That's just me. Most of my friends do. My wife and daughter went to march for it. I don't, because I don't think there should have been a first one. I generally think that referendum are too simple. Or you have lots, like in Switzerland, and you get used to referendum. And my other Machiavellian personal selfish reason for not wanting to go for a second referendum is I think Leave could win it. And I personally don't want to leave. And if you have a second referendum and Leave win, you're definitely going to be out.
Do you think if the votes with no confidence would have been successful, that would have had any effect on
the EU? If she lost the votes with no confidence in her, she would have had to resign. It would be unbelievable that she would have. You get into really, because we have no constitution, in other way we're odd. You know, the Queen would have to phone her up and say, really, it's time to go. So she'd have to resign. And and then the question is whether they could come up quickly with another Prime Minister inside the Conservative Party or not. The Conservative Party really, really don't want an election. The only thing that they're unified on is no election. And they're unified to the last MP on that. So is there one more? Yes?
I was really interested in what you were saying about immigration and things like that. I'm a Remainer, I've got a problem with immigration. I saw a very interesting graph in The Economist about a year ago looking at mapping constituents who voted Leave or Remain against the pace of
the
immigration.
The recent, yeah.
Yeah, and so then it was easier to, you could see there was another pattern going on, which is not about the quantity of change, which you pointed out clearly, you know, places with the smallest amount of immigration voting to leave, but you could see a pattern with this graph showing that where you get rates of immigration that have changed, it was above 5 or 10%, there was a correlation with the leave vote there.
You're completely right. I mean, East Anglia, where people came in to farm, parts of Sheffield where there were 200 Roma in this part of Sheffield. A lot of it is the stoking up of fear around it. But it's much easier to stoke up the fear of immigration if you've got a new Polish shop on the high street. So the change has effect. But the really sad thing about this, one of the things, if you're kind of listing things you can be proud about Britain, we have a higher rate of immigration for longer, for more places than most of the rest of Europe. You can be quite shocked going to some parts of Europe about people's racism, because they haven't seen people who weren't white. Whereas we were actually a country that was quite good at integrating, being multicultural. So the idea that we're still affected by the sudden arrival of an extra 5% of people who are coming to pick crops that you don't want to pick. I mean, the immigrants only arrive when there's work for them to do because somebody else doesn't want to do it. It's the main thing.
There is a conversation about the pace of change, isn't there? And some of those, their impact on services in some of those areas is kind of large. So is this about, have you seen any other data that looks at the need vote and suggest it might be about sort of change of pace of change?
Well, no, because remember, the vast majority of leave areas haven't had change. This is about a very small number of places that have had a change of voted leave. But Hampshire hasn't had a huge influx of people. And the services, of course, are disproportionately provided by immigrants. So a higher number of school teachers are immigrants than the general population, nurses. The John Radcliffe Hospital here only operates on immigrants. One in three midwives in London is an EU citizen but not a UK citizen. One in three midwives. And the babies, I mean, there are people who, you know, are 2 months pregnant now in London, and one in three midwives in the middle of London are not British citizens. This is hard to believe. Young man in the back.
If another referendum was to be held right now, yeah, what do you think the result would be?
They'd have to hold it, they couldn't hold it.
Well, it hypothetically.
I think the result would be leave just, because there'd be an anger stoked up. It's the same newspapers writing the same things owned by the same men, who actually are often immigrants, the actual owners and non-domiciles. It's the same concerns within people's hearts about things. So I think leave would do we should leave, okay, we need to plan for it a bit more. You know, we need to worry about medicines in the way we weren't worrying about medicines, we need to do this and that. But of course, theoretically, it should be entirely possible to leave. It's a relatively rich country, it shouldn't be impossible to leave. I would expect the referendum would play down on the idea we'll do a delay and we'll leave in 2 years' time. And it's just my gut feeling that the way you can stir up patriotism, the elite are nobbling you, they fix this, they ask you once, and because you didn't give them the answer you wanted. I may be too cynical. One thing we've learned because of the result, if it had gone the other way, we wouldn't have learned this, because nobody would have investigated the Brexiteers. You know, if it had been 48% leave, 52% remain, nobody would have looked into Aaron Banks and said, where did you get that £1 million from? Nobody would have looked at Cambridge Analytica. Nobody would be looking at the motivations of some of the MPs and the major Brexiteers. Many of the older Brexiteers, these are the people who run the campaign and funded it, grew up in colonies with servants in kind of an empire situation. They are determined. This really, really matters to them. It's not the public at large. This is the people who ran and led the various Leave campaigns. Jacob Rees-Mogg's father wrote a book called Sovereign Wealth with somebody else before he died, his last book, which is a book about how important it is for Britain to be entirely separated from the rest of Europe. So one thing we've learned in the last 2 years is that there are a group of people for whom this is really, really important, and they're people with recourse to a lot of money, and it matters to them.
Do you think Theresa May could have done a better job, and if someone else in my place, it could have been done more effectively? Do you think?
Could somebody have done a better job than Theresa?
Yeah, people know who it is, somebody like.
She grew up here. If she would be just there, if she was in this room, so she got Forest Hill and Wheatley, and went to my department. So I always feel sorry for her. I don't think any Conservative leader could have dealt with this. I think this has been a running sore in the Conservative Party since Margaret Thatcher could no longer control them. It's what got John Major into trouble. It's like the Corn Law debate. And I don't think somebody could have done a better job than Theresa. And she's at least dogged. You know, she sleeps 2 or 3 hours a night. She's absolutely dedicated. She's not my favourite politician. But compared to the alternatives, you know, Boris Johnson and so on, she looks more competent.
You sort of answered my question, but should David Cameron have stayed and gutted it out?
That would have been interesting. He didn't say he would go. He didn't, because I can remember Andrew Marr came to the university, and the interesting thing about Andrew Marr's talk was he said David Cameron will absolutely resign if he loses this, even though he hasn't said he would. And Andrew Marr was spot on. I think it would have been a responsible thing to do. I think if you make a mess, you should. David Cameron was in a way unlucky, because if you look at his life, everything had worked out. He'd always been lucky. Only 1 in 3 boys from Eton get to go to Oxford or Cambridge. He was in the 1 in 3. Most fail. He didn't just go to Oxford, he went to the posh college in Brasenose. He didn't just do that, he got the first class degree. He almost got 2-1. He got the right wife. He got the £90,000 a year job at Carlton TV. He became leader really young. He got a majority at the time you shouldn't have done. Everything worked out for Dale in a way that was partly luck. And he thought he was naturally lucky. And his friend George Osborne told him not to do it. And he did it. I think the right thing to do would be to stay around and clear it up. But he's never had to do that because nothing has ever gone wrong in his life before. Do you do one last question? Or two last ones. So you there, then you at the back.
Do you think that it would be a good idea for the government to do another referendum about what type of Brexit that the British population would like?
I don't like referendums. What I would do instead is change the voting system so that we went to a normal European PR voting system so that all your votes mattered. If you do that, you don't have two main parties, you end up with 8 or 9. And you can all have a political party that you like. There's a tiny party in Greece called the River, and I really like the River. They only get 0.5% of the vote, but they're my politics, you know. So if you're worried about democracy and choice, rather than ask for more referendum, I'd ask for a form of proportional representation where you can actually get to vote for what you believe in. Because in Britain, essentially, you have to tactically vote, unless you're lucky to live in a constituency and agree entirely with the political party that's in power there. You have to think, do I vote for the person I don't really want, the sort of person I really, really don't want? And it doesn't make people really want to vote very much, so that's why I change. Very last question at the back. Is there much of a chance? If a majority of MPs can organise themselves to demand it and take control of that House of Commons, take control of Parliament in 3 or 4 weeks, it's possible. They haven't shown an ability to work together. Conservative MPs would have to work with Labour MPs in a group where they had more than 310, 320 of them. There'll be somebody here who knows the history. I don't know the last time that MPs took over control of the government from the party of government. That's partly what it would take. It really would be interesting. If you forget watching news for the rest of your life, you do want to be watching it between now and March 29th. And then the real problem is the question. Because there's a referendum act, and it basically says you can only have 2 questions, you can't have 3. You need new legislation for 3. And it's actually quite hard to work out. If you're only allowed to have 2 options, what are they? So you can go into it. I think the people's vote thing is tricky. My personal preference is that this goes on, we get a complete mess, we begin to get really worried about it, and maybe not on the 29th of March, but possibly Theresa May sends email. And because we don't riot, and we don't protest, we don't need to call the army in, people write lots of very angry emails and blogs and so on. We're still in the EU the day after. We have to suddenly be in the European elections, and that's really tricky, because there'll be a kind of people's vote, which is in May of this year. If you vote Article 50, people get to vote in European elections, and they may vote a clean UKIP slate in. And then we sit and work out what we really want to do, rather than doing it on this kind of knife edge thing. And we involve people of your age, and of course not the people who died, who mainly voted Leave. Because simple demographics prove the balance somewhat. Thank you very much for putting up with me. Please think of doing jobs for university.